a walk in the park. Really, several parks. This is a geyser in Yellowstone. We'll go to Zion in Utah and the Everglades in Florida. I'm Barrett Golding. This is Hearing Voices from NPR. We start in Washington, D.C., a neighborhood where producer Katie Davis grew up, Adams Morgan. This is the first of a few stories from Walter Pierce Community Park.
Walk through our park, and one of the first people you'll come across is Bobby. Big, burly Bobby. He's sewn pockets onto his cut-off sweatpants, and there's a hunting knife and scissors poking up. A stuffed bear hangs off his waist. Newcomers ask, "Should I worry about that guy?" "No, that's just Bobby," we say. He keeps the park clean.
More people know me than I know them. People always call my name, but I don't know who they are.
Bobby didn't set out to look after our park when he arrived 25 years ago and started a small garden. But he's there every day now, doing what the city has no money to do and what the park group pays him a few dollars to do. He cuts weeds like he did back on his family cotton farm in South Carolina. He picks up dirty diapers in the playground, soda cans at the basketball court, and piles the overflowing trash cans onto a jury-rigged shopping cart and pushes it to the dumpster.
I cleaned them yesterday morning. No, Friday morning, yeah.
Bobby's the first to know when the water fountain backs up and when someone beheads the daylilies for fun. He doesn't call to report this, though. Just laces the wilting flowers through my iron gate, and I know he's been by. Every morning, Bobby's in our park, checking on things, using a golf club for a cane because his legs give him trouble now from his diabetes. He wears an ankle bracelet with bells, but it doesn't really jangle.
I'm still in the country. Yeah, just walking around the city, but I still talk like I'm in the country. And I move like I'm in the country, too. But you would think I'd work for the government.
Last summer, the park group set out to make Bobby's watering chores easier. We bought 10 gator bags, plastic pouches that sit at the base of trees and soak the roots slowly. Bobby hated those bags. First, he told me the rats ate holes in them. I checked, and it wasn't true. Then he hid the bags. I put them back. Eventually, I realized those watering bags were scab laborers to Bobby. He was union, doing work the honorable way. It's something my old neighbor Ellen noticed, too, as she and her son spent days at the playground.
Well, I think Bobby really found his place in the world when this park came, and he really loves it, and it makes him feel important. And he is important here, and he very much is part of this. If I came back here and Bobby didn't work here anymore, I'm sure this park would look 10 times worse than the last time I saw it. But this is Bobby's world, and he loves it, and he takes care of it. And it's like hard work gives you back something to your soul that money doesn't.
Bobby would never say that. He doesn't waste words. But come any dry August morning, and you'll find Bobby at dawn, pulling hose, 300 unruly feet of it. He's got to soak those new red buds and dogwoods the park people planted. And while he might put water in those gator bags, he will also douse the trees his way, so they'll sink their roots deep and wide, so they'll give good shade 30 years from now.
You used to be able to drive right to the base of Angel's Landing, but now you have to take the caterpillar-like shuttle bus from the new visitor center.
This little stone building on our right was the first visitor center in Zion National Park. It had about 15 visitors per day then. Now we have about 2.7 million visitors each year.
The road follows the Virgin River up Zion Canyon. The sides of the canyon are like the cliff faces of Yosemite, only the rock here is yellow and red sandstone, 2,000 feet high and sometimes arched at the top. It feels like being inside a huge body. Canyon walls or the ribcage spread open, and Angel's Landing, where we're going, is like the heart.
This is the grotto trailhead for Angel's Landing. Angel's Landing is a difficult hike to some. It takes about 4 hours round trip, and take plenty of water if you do go on this hike. If you're going to access those trails today, go to the rear of the bus, go right across the road and the bridge.
From the river, we look pretty much straight up and see where we're going. The top of a thin red mesa that stands alone in the middle of the canyon, 1,500 feet above our heads.
Hi.
The people walking up are sweaty and doubtful. The people coming down are smiling and happy.
Hey there.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good.
What's it like getting up there? What's the trail like?
The trail's pretty paved. It is strenuous, like they tell you in the magazine. But the first part's just kind of steep and hot, and the last part is on the chain. And you got to drop off on either side. And as long as you have a good balance, you can make it. But, I mean, this family here, he has a couple of kids. They made it all the way to the top. So right. It's...
How old are you?
I think, 11.
Right, good. How was it?
It was really good.
Seven.
It was awesome.
Did you go all the way to top to Angel's Landing?
It was kind of scary in some parts.
We passed two couples from France and two couples from Japan, as well as the guy who operates the elevator at the Shalimar Hotel in Las Vegas. We leave him where the chains start, trying to decide whether he wants to go up or down. The trail from here is more like climbing up the edge of a knife, so the Park Service has installed a chain you can hold on to keep from flying off the mountain. We get passed on this part by four BYU co-eds, followed by a young man quoting Henry V.
Rather proclaim it throughout my host that he which hath no stomach for this fight, let him depart. His passport shall be made, crowns for a convoy.
There are good wide steps chopped into the sandstone, but if you tripped in certain places and let go of the chain, it'd be like falling off the Empire State Building. Far below, the Caterpillar shuttle bus inches along the river road. There's a crowd on top, a party of people who don't know each other and will never see each other again, all high on gravity. Mostly half-clothed college students, but also a barbarian hiker with leather boots worn out in the Alps, and a nurse from Belgium carrying a copy of Desert Solitaire in her backpack. It seems entirely possible, standing on top, that this is a place angels would land. It's an altar, 1,500 feet in the air, surrounded by the yellow and red walls of the canyon that are another 500 feet higher. It feels like all the energy coming off these walls is focused on this spot. It knocks you over just looking at them. The sun starts setting, the people leave. We stay and wait for a sign from the supernatural world. When we listen closely, we think we hear the sound of the canyon humming, and then realize it's the sound of the shuttle bus resonating against the walls of the canyon. Then we remember we have to ride that bus. We pack up and run down, barely making the last bus of the day.
This bus is headed back to the visitor center.
Leah's doing hair. Sit on the bench while the guys run to 20. Sit on the edge, right there.
Sam six.
Lean your head now. Leah pulls her comb, combs your hair out. So much hair, let it bunch, blow around, tumble out of bounds.
Now you learn how to do it, huh?
Leah's hands, hands that embroider, braiding curves, curving braids. Leah's twisting hair. Twist it, one, two, lucky if she's twisting you. Leah's doing hair. Lolita and Nona keeping company, and Frenchie, Leah's guy, rides in and out of the park on his bike, to the store, up to the corner, and back again. Leah's doing hair. Come here, Brandon, with your big, wild hair. Sit down and don't be tender-headed. Tomorrow, Brandon's head gleams, etched with tight rows, rows telling everyone, someone takes care of me.
Katie Davis from her series Neighborhood Stories. You are taking a walk in the park with Hearing Voices. That was Scott Carrier from Zion National Park. In a moment, we're back in Walter Pierce Park with Katie Davis, right after a little bit from Jill Scott. She goes on long walks after dark in the park.
Baby, I feel free. Come on and go with me.
temptation, education, relaxation, elevation. Maybe we can talk about Surah 31:18.
Every spring, I get the phone calls. Hi, I just moved into the neighborhood, and I want to get a plot in the community garden. What should I do? The best way, I tell them, is to go to the garden around 5:30 in the morning and look for Victor. He'll be filling the water barrels. This is not what they want to hear. They want to sign up on the phone, or better yet, by email. It is city land, after all. There should be a system, they say. Victor is the system, I tell them. You can find him in the garden just as the light begins to fill the sky.
By yourself, your mind is at ease. And when you hear the birds start singing, tak, tak, tak. Oh, yeah.
Victor Zabina of Martinique. He knows every plot and every gardener's story, all 40 of them.
Hello, stranger.
How are you?
And I'll give you some beans, some pole beans you can put against the fence. You can climb on the fence.
Victor's power is rooted in the days when there was no garden here, no park even, just an abandoned field. 35 years ago, he paced off a finger-shaped parcel for the community garden, and since then he's been in charge. Victor, Don Victor, and here is where it might help to kneel and take his hand. Can I please have a piece of land to grow a few tomatoes?
Estos son palitos de chile.
For decades, Victor handed out roomy plots about the size of a garage door. Mostly to Latinos. Not many others asked. He gave the land as if writing a prescription. You've lost your way in this country, Victor would say. Go, put your hands in the earth.
Listen, there is one they call Lalo. He was drunk, and he was having trouble with his life. He never sent money to his wife and his kids. He came one day, he was crying, and he talked to me. He told me, if you give me a piece of land, I'll try to stay here until sundown, and then I'll go home to sleep.
Lalo did stop drinking and sent money to El Salvador for his wife to buy land and a house. That was 5 years ago, and most afternoons you can still find Lalo fertilizing his corn at the bottom of a steep hill.
Este pedazo es feo, es todo feo. La tierra es la más fea que tengo, la tierra que es más fea que tengo yo, pero me encanta estar aquí porque me divierto.
This patch is ugly, but I love it, says Lalo. Let's see how long they let me keep it. Lalo feels change in the garden and the neighborhood. Once working class, now wealthier, more professional. And that means more supplicants in search of Victor, a problem he solves by dividing the plots and redividing them. And it's getting crowded here in the garden. A few years ago, Victor gave some land to an Albanian immigrant and ushered in a new era. We watched as the Albanian turned his soil. We'd never seen anyone garden in a black suit, smoking unfiltered cigarettes. But he knew what he was doing, molding thick rows and then planting masses of beans that sprouted quickly. One morning, the Albanian came into the garden, stooped over with a load of warped plywood and formica on his back. And then he started hammering and hammering, and just like that, his garden was completely walled in. It's amazing how instantly our trust evaporated, how it was no longer good enough to place a few rocks to mark boundaries. People wrapped chicken wire around their lettuce, barbed wire around the rosemary. One couple erected a chain-link fence and padlocked it. The community garden was balkanized. Every year, someone tries to just go around Victor and take a plot.
And hey, basta. Facciamo finita.
Tessa arrived at our park with her terrier on the back of her scooter, pining to get her hands dirty like she did back in Italy. She first met Country Bobby. Everyone does, because he's in the garden 7 days a week. Bobby pointed to an abandoned plot and told Tessa, go ahead, take that one.
I cleaned it, I planted it, and fenced it and everything else. The next day I came back. All of my plants had been ripped out, and then they'd taken the 3 garbage cans and dumped them in the middle.
So Tessa went to Victor, and he gave her a plot. She spent hours there, fussing with her roses and lettuce, ignoring the tomato thieves, and talking to everyone.
The majority of the new people that are here are in D.C. in transition for probably their 2.5 years while they're working on the hill, and they decorate their garden beautifully with gold-painted rocks and mobiles made of blue bottles, which is absolutely beautiful. But the people who are here who are gardening because they need the tomatoes to be able to make preserve to eat throughout the winter are like, that's not what we want for our garden.
Tessa talked like an old-timer, but she did things that were unnerving. She called the police when people barbecued in their plots. She lobbied Victor to take down all the fences because she didn't like the way they looked. That summer, anger grew. Miguel attacked Victor when plants were pulled up from his plot. Miguel insisted the plants were to honor his dead mother. Victor said they were marijuana seedlings. Miguel threatened to cut Victor's head off with a machete, and Tessa was right in the middle of it.
Fight breaks out. It's three Latinos against Victor, who can hold his own even at 75. Throw him down, kick him, we call the police, they get arrested.
The police found a machete hidden in the garden plot and confiscated it. It all got to be too much for Tessa, especially after her scooter was vandalized. That's when she decided to step back.
If I were them and I were as angry, the next thing I would go for is my dog. And I come from a country where dogs are poisoned all the time as warning signs.
After that summer, Tessa gave notice on her plot and transplanted her rose bushes into the children's butterfly garden, my plot. To make room, she ripped out a half dozen bushes, spirea bushes, which she had always hated, but the butterflies loved. They'd been there 20 years. Tessa left for Italy, and I stayed, deeply rooted that I am. I've found that is often the best strategy against those who promote change in my neighborhood without talking it through. Wait them out. They get tired of the unruliness and unpredictability. I spent the whole winter thinking about where to move Tessa's rose bushes. And in the spring, I dug them up, gently, mind you. And then I put them in their place, another place.
Watch the surface. You see that this feature is now still in the process of enlarging. We've got an area over 2 meters across where the whole ground is pulsating. Now beginning to erupt. And now it's over. Nice short one. It's, you know, just a very, very narrow slit in the rock. So then that the water that's in the geyser starts flashing or exploding into steam. And those explosions and pushing the water out is what causes the eruption. Under Yellowstone, there's a zone of partially molten rock left over from the last big caldera eruption a little over 600,000 years ago, and it created a crater that was 45 kilometers wide and 75 kilometers long and dumped volcanic ash and drifts in eastern Nebraska and South Dakota and Kansas and some places more than 6 meters deep. And then following that big eruption, we've had volcanic activity continuing since then. And then rainwater and snowmelt seeps down into the volcanic plateau here. The volcanic rock is very, very porous. And it goes down to near where the semi-molten rock is and gets heated. Right now, the geyser tube is slowly filling. You can see that the water is almost to the top of the vent. It's fun feeling the ground shake underneath you when a powerful geyser goes off, or getting coated by ice in the winter as the wind shifts and the spray of a geyser lands on your coat. The areas of geysers in the world are very, very rare. There's geysers in New Zealand, Iceland, Kamchatka in eastern Siberia, and then at very, very high elevations in Tibet. But you add up all the other geysers in the world, there are fewer than what's here in Yellowstone. Most of the other areas of the world where there are geysers is being destroyed by the extraction of heat and water through geothermal development for energy, space heating, electrical power. This place is protected.
This is 700 with a special announcement. A Powder River tour bus touring the park with a group of Japanese tourists needs to be in both at 2 p.m. to catch a flight today. However, they have left a passenger at the Best Western lobby in Gardner. If you have contact with this bus, please inform them that they are missing a passenger. 700, 10 hours, 13 minutes.
Geologist Rick Hutchinson. He was Yellowstone's geyser guy. In 1997, he died in an avalanche. He was out on a cross-country ski trip checking thermal features. Coming up, we're deep in the Everglades with the Florida panther as we continue our walk in the park on Hearing Voices.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
You are hearing voices of Katie Davis and her neighbors in D.C.'s Walter Pierce Community Park.
When I go sit by the court for a while, I know that between games of 5-on-5 and who's got next, someone will look over and ask, when's the tournament? They know that we just had it, that it's always the second week in July, but they ask anyway. And I always tell them, because this is part of getting ready all year long.
Man, what you gonna do, man?
All year long, Moochie says, we'll beat Jesse and them this time. All year long, Brian, who's 33, plots to beat Courtney's team. 5 years, and he's still losing. This time he'll get Gerard on his team. Never mind that Gerard's a showboat. He's got a great handle.
Hey, Gerard, you got like pipe that joint.
When I started the tournament 10 years ago, it was for little kids. But within a few years, it became a ritual for boys and men. A way to sort out who's who can talk trash and back it up, who's up and coming, who better sit down. A way to tell stories.
It was me. I'm like Iverson. Without me, there would be no team. I'm the team. You know what I'm saying? I made all the shots. All they had to do was take it out and give me the ball. I'm Jeremiah, the world's greatest. I had 42 points.
Yeah, Jeremiah, all fury and drama on the court. But his legs get him above the rim every time. Makes the old legs pray to the backboard.
Make that layup, Mo! Yeah! There you go, baby! There you go!
When knees wear out, men in their 30s shift to strategy. Months before the tournament, they start pressing me for the pairings. Who plays who? Who plays first? They can't forgive me for last year when I scheduled the two best teams before the crowd even got there. This year I told Ryan, you know, I'm thinking about drawing straws.
You don't draw straws. If you draw straws, we'd end up with exactly the same thing where, you know, how you would do it is the historic powerhouses of the tournament are are Sam and Courtney's teams. So you have Sam's team, which...
The men want the day organized just so. Drama unfolding between Sam and Courtney's teams, or Brian and Ant's, peaking right around 5 p.m. when the whole neighborhood is packed along the sidelines.
Let's push the ball! Push the ball!
After each game, I hold my breath because someone usually throws a tantrum. The question is, are they going to throw a chair? Violence courses through these games, and it gets right to the edge. The trick is to keep it there.
Foul! Damn it! Foul!
Don't shoot, Gerard!
Run the fuck out! Don't get upset! Yell and play!
These tournament games, these 20-minute games on a runty, cracked court, they're chewed on the whole year. Replayed from one angle and then another.
Get back!
Yeah, we lost by 1 point in the last 10 seconds of the game.
Man on! Hands up!
So upon the opposing team taking out, one of our players goes out of bounds and knocks the ball out of his hands while he's out of bounds, which is a technical foul, which they shot and they made, and they got the ball and they made that, which gave them the game.
After my brother Sam went down to Courtney's team 3 years in a row, he went recruiting. And when he came back, he had 2 6-foot-6ers, one with a flawless jumper.
Chris Elvey, who was a player for University of Pennsylvania and also who played in Europe professionally, and Thomas Treadwell, who was a very well-known ball player.
Yes, Sam got his win, 36-35. And then for months, my brother would drop by the Safeway, slide into Courtney's checkout line, and ask, "How you feeling?" This went on for a year, until Courtney's guys, Mike, Pooby, Tank, and Face, until they reclaimed their title. Mike says he's going to retire this year. No one wants to be like the guy who missed an easy layup in front of everyone. He quit right then and there, relegated himself to the sidelines with the old guys.
Watch the one in the corner! Watch the one in the corner!
The old guys. They do the thinking. Young men, the running. Back and forth, back and forth. The solos on the court. The chorus on the sidelines. The call and response of the game.
Katie Davis from her series Neighborhood Stories. Okay, this next piece is a radio classic by Christina Egloff and Jay Allison. They're talking with Lance Corporal James McMullen in Everglades National Park. It's called Jungles of Memory.
Well, think about this. It's July. You're in Vietnam. It's 100 degrees. You're hacking through a forest a lot thicker than you can ever see here with a machete until you drop. You go in at 170 pounds, and 1 month you're down to 145. Guys are going down with heat exhaustion. Now you got to fight the Viet Cong. He's ambushing. He's doing something nutty to you, right? So when I came in here, or when I came to the Everglades, people would ask me, geez, you know, coming to the Everglades like that after Vietnam War, I would think it was the last thing you want to see is jungle. Yeah, and it was the opposite. To come into the Everglades and to look around like this and not see a possible ambush or a Vietnamese face, whether it's Viet Cong or just a villager, you know, sneaking around a corner looking at you, to know that the somebody isn't out here that's going to take a shot at you or you're going to trip a wire, why, hell, Everglades, piece of cake.
As I write this, I'm in my canoe, drifting in the Florida Everglades in search of the endangered panther. The layers of August heat creep across this wild land in waves. I watch the stillness seem to move as a breeze pushes the heat across water and sawgrass. I need only to move to sweat. Vietnam was the same.
I came back from Nam in 67. When we were flying over the Pacific Ocean, I had a concept, very naive at the time, that I could be the person I was before I went to Vietnam. You know, that was kind of a very naive. It was my hometown I grew up in, and I was invisible. My friends were distant, very distant. And suddenly, I wasn't a part of it anymore. You know, I was just a completely different person. And then I would get to drinking. And I drank everything. I couldn't hold on to a job. You know, it was just, I would get all psyched up, pack my bag, and want to go back to Vietnam. Wiped out my car. You know, I mean, I did some really crazy stuff. And suddenly it was all over. And I didn't have any more money. Oh, hell, what are we going to do now? And I read this little article in the paper that said all the Florida Panthers in Everglades are extinct.
I'd read a brief article in a Chicago newspaper that said there were no more Florida Panthers in the Everglades.
I've never been to Florida in my entire life. I just told my wife, I said, we're going to Florida. I'm going to Everglades.
I drove all those hours down the road with no idea what I'd find at the end of it. After 3 days of nonstop driving, half of it in the rain, I arrived in Florida and drove all the way down to Everglades City, the last town on the West Coast before the Everglades takes over.
It just grabbed me that this cat could never go extinct. And later I found out really what I was probably saying, that I was never going to go extinct. And a Green Beret, he says, I read your book. And he says, you know, Cry the Panther. He says, very good title. He says, it's you crying, wasn't it? It wasn't a panther, it was you. Okay, now take it easy. Take it easy. She's going to do a job on me here in a minute. I'm going to get another scratch, aren't I? You don't scare me. I felt I was taken over for a period of time by the Everglades and the panther. I really did. To be caught up in the swamp.
Okay, where are you going?
With a wild animal. Obsessed. To where nothing else matters, including my wife and family. And never wanting to leave the swamp. We're talking almost a total possession. Okay, and it's a very eerie feeling to know that you're not in fully control of things.
now you're getting mad, aren't you? Am I going to get another scar? I got scars all over my body, don't I? That you've given me. Let's just do it one more time.
You know, I was mesmerized by the cats, and I knew I wanted a cat. I literally met a man in the swamp. He was fascinated with my tracking the cat in the wilds. And tracker came from a litter of one of his captive bred panthers that is out in the Everglades. I started raising Tracker when she was like 3.5 days old. She's 5 years and 10 months now. And she came out with me in the swamp to track wild panthers. She was in my pocket. She was in my backpack. Then she got bold enough to walk alongside of me and make circles. And she taught me more about panthers than any human being could possibly.
Oh, okay. Hey, no claws. No claws. Hey, Tracker, no claws. No claws. No jumping. Stay. Now, don't jump. No! No! Okay.
People should realize I've been tracking cats and proving panthers exist to give to the environmental organizations so that they can take it into court as breaking federal and state laws, okay, endangered species laws. If that's what it's going to take for them to understand that you can't destroy everything that exists in the name of development, then so be it. But more important than that, again, this is a symptom that if we can continue to do that kind of development, there isn't going to be anything left. I mean, it's dying right now, and people don't care. Yeah? And if they did, it wouldn't be going on like this. The developer's point of view is, oh, he's just out to save the panther, fine and good. But really what it amounts to is save the panther. You save the Everglades. I'd set up my own mission. Come hell or high water, I was going to say something. And, well, you know, in Vietnam, there's no way in hell you were trying to save a country, but you were destroying it at the same time, you know, and that really got to me. Those are F-4. I believe they're F-4 Phantoms out of Homestead Air Force Base down there. And they're constantly practicing bombing runs over the Everglades.
We had F-4 Phantoms in Vietnam. They come right over the top of us like that. Boy, they come over, it was just ear-shattering, you know. I mean, God, you can't imagine the sound of a jet coming right over top of you, roughly 20 feet above. And the whole side of the hill would light up with napalm. It just triggered a numb flashback. It just, boom, I had a flashback.
I heard a faint popping sound.
Was it the LSD thing, you know, where bang?
Felt a void.
I was just relived it.
Then saw small Vietnamese children running out in front of our perimeter trying to get out of the village. We had set fire to their houses, burned their rice barrels and piles of firewood. With C4 plastic explosives, hand grenades, and Zippo lighter fluid, we had blown up their bomb shelters and village square. Suddenly, Marines were screaming about a baby left in one of the houses. I wanted to drop my rifle and run to the houses, but the lieutenant wouldn't let us off the line. He ran out and into a house and came back out empty-handed. Others ran out and began checking the houses they could get into, but it was no use. The hooches were crumbling under the flames. Later, after the bulldozers had knocked down the remains, the charcoaled infant was put in a small bag and choppered out.
Every once in a while, I still have that feeling of the... every Nam vet, whether he was in combat or not, feels some kind of a guilt. And I did for an awful long time, too. And sometimes it does get to me. I'm thinking, we could have done a hell of a lot more for those people. We didn't really, in a lot of ways, we did not treat them as people, human beings, you know. So that guilt will... And for me, it's... I accepted what happened. I think that's what the key is there. You know, I'm not saying everybody should do it this way. But you're eventually going to have to face up to all that stuff. I know there's a lot of non-vets walking around won't dare even talk about it. And, okay, I take non-vets out here with me. Do some tracking and survival skills, you know, just have a good time. Nothing heavy, you know. I'm not saying it'll work with everybody, though. I had a Green Beret. He's scared to go out with me. He read my book, and he's had... When he was in Nam, he got caught off guard, and he had to, you know, do some killing he didn't want to do. And he's afraid of that. And when he's with me, he thinks I'm going to, because I'm open about it, and because I wrote the book, that I'm going to try and corner him in to feeling his own guilt. You know, and so he doesn't dare go out with me. And I wouldn't, you know, but I think it's my mere presence that would conjure that up for him. And I don't, and so he shouldn't be out here. He shouldn't be with me, and he shouldn't be out here, you know. Now, Mike is just the opposite, you know. Mike is very verbal, and he's faced up to almost everything, you know, that went on over there. And he considers to be, he was an honorable soldier, you know. He's a hero. He's very modest about it. He won't even tell you that, but he won the Silver Star, the Bronze Star, wounded 3 times, 2 accommodations. He was a tunnel rat. He was the one who went down the tunnels to chase the VC down the tunnels. And there's a lot of similarities. We were laughing one night. We were talking about all the similarities. I was at Chulai. He was at Chulai. I got wounded 3 times. He got wounded 3 times. I got wounded in the back. He got wounded in the
back. We had so many parallels. We'd both come from the same state. We were both from Illinois. Both came to Florida. Both, you know, Vietnam veterans, of course. And we actually were both on the same firebase in Chulai. And, you know, like Jim is doing a very good study of the Panther. And... I've been doing some of the same stuff with the alligator, you know, here in Florida. And when the two of us are out on a walk, it's like nobody I ever walked with before. It's like that one special person. You know, he don't have to say anything to me. I kind of know what he's doing or where he's headed with something or, you know, what's coming up. You know, we can be walking along and talking and stuff, and all of a sudden we'll both go real quiet, you know. We'll laugh and, you know, truck on. And it's just a thought process that I think we share, that, you know, and trust. You know, I have Jim behind me any day of the week.
Yeah, I tell you, man, it sure as hell looks like a panther track right there.
Those are nice prints.
Mm. Yeah, those are super prints right here.
Yeah.
And this is looks like he just kind of dug in.
Yeah, this one here, I definitely agree. Yeah. I just happened to see that there.
Yeah, that's a little bit bigger.
You know, what he may have done is he stepped here, then a foot here, and then he jumped.
Yeah. I mean, that's a
There you go, you know.
Track. That's what had me going. Was that
stuff? Yeah, that stuff. Yeah.
Big track.
Okay, on this, we'll go single file through here. And that's good rattlesnake country. Is this okay, Mike, going through this stuff? You're all right with it?
Oh, no problem.
There's a trail over here. Okay, this panther here walks this whole trail in a dry season. It comes off the edge there, goes all the way to the cypress. That's just nice. About the first 500 yards going in is just a hell of a nice walk.
Jesus, this looks like a rice paddy fields all over the place, you know. These humps out here could be a water buffalo sitting in the water.
You know what it is to me? It's the sound of the four of us walking through the water.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
Out on patrol.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get that too.
But it's not unpleasant. I mean, it doesn't bother me. You know, it's almost a pleasant feeling. I mean, we're in the woods, we're doing a good thing, you know where you're at.
Yeah.
You know, nobody's going to pop off at you.
Yeah.
This is still a great way to spend the day, though, isn't it?
Ah, yeah. Ah, yeah.
Hunting season. I wandered off the trail and down into a small slough, then through more trees and up close to a weathered, destroyed cabin. A rifle cracked in the wind, and the distinct sound of a bullet rushed through the air. It was that sound of rifle fire close to me. The projectile speeding overhead that instantly triggered the overwhelming memory of when I was wounded in Nam. I slid down alongside the cabin wall. Tears welled up in my eyes, ran down my face. My hands shook and my throat was dry. My stomach ached, cries of pain echoing from the wounded, and a shattering of hope that I'd be going home alive. It was in 1966, south of Chulai Base Camp.
I'll get you in the cypress pretty quick here. I want to check this hole out over there, too.
Oh, Jesus.
Where's Mike? We got ourselves a moccasin here about roughly 3.5, maybe 4 feet. Over here. Come on over here. Look for another one. There's a chance there's another one hanging in there. That's about as close as you want to get, because he could get to you on a strike there.
Yeah.
Keep in mind, if they strike once and miss, they keep coming at you, okay, until they hit you. Okay.
It was in 1966, south of Chulai Base Camp. I was with 8 other Marines. I sat at the back end of the truck, staring out at the South China Sea, drenched, my flak jacket waterlogged, rifle cradled in my lap, coated with wet sand and rusting around the barrel. We started off down the road, our truck taking point. We rolled up the canvas on the sides of the truck and let the wind cool us off. Suddenly, a terrific, muffled explosion underneath the front of our truck blew up mud and metal and slammed the truck up and then back on the road. I tried to grab my rifle, but it flew out of my hands onto the floor. The truck bounced and slid off the road into the bushes, rammed a mud mound, and stopped. We had driven over a buried VC landmine. We all looked at each other.
And you say, like I told myself when I left Vietnam, that I wasn't ever going to go back in the wilderness, in the forest. And it was the complete opposite.
Yeah, it's like sometimes you seek it out, that you want to be in the woods or you want to go back. I will get feelings of deja vu, flashbacks, be canoeing into really overgrown, thick areas where all of a sudden the light's gone. And you'll kind of go, you know, whoa, have I been here before?
Yeah.
But because in Chulai and to the west in the highlands, that's what we dealt mostly with was tunnels, a lot of tunnels. And
you're down in there, you're in a tunnel big enough for you to get through.
You know, we tried all different kinds of electronics and everything, but it ended up with just a man, a .45 and a flashlight. And underground warfare is unbelievable. Yeah. You'd think at least you'd intimidate them, and they wouldn't even slow down. I mean, they just keep coming at you and coming at you. It's unbelievable.
The Marine next to me yelled, "Ambush, ambush." And suddenly bullets were tearing through the canvas top in a chatter of small arms fire from our right flank in the bushes with a noise like balloons popping. The VC were right next to us, yards away, filling the truck with bullets. I dove headfirst down into the equipment on the floor, but the Marine sitting directly across from me was a second too slow. A machine gun clattered from the bushes and raked the backside of the truck, blasting right over my head. I could hear the repulsive sound of bullets splitting and splattering flesh. When I looked up, I stared into glazed, vacant eyes. Eyes that now held half-death, half-life. Eyes that stared at me for years to come in nightmares, on street corners, at parties, when making love, when getting so drunk I was sick for days after. The left side of his head was slashed open wide. A chunk of his skull was missing, and gray liquid mixed with watery blood and matter slid down his head. Half of his neck had been blown off by the machine gun. He tried to turn and bend toward me, making a horrifying, gurgling sound and pointing at his rifle. I put my arm around his waist and tried to get him under me, but there was no room. Warm, thick blood poured all over my face, back, and arms. Then the VC opened up on us still again and pinned us down completely. All we could do was pray. Suddenly, I felt like someone had kicked me as hard as he could in the back. Striking pain went all over my back as though it were splitting apart. But my legs were okay and I could move around. I took the Marine who was on top of me and gently laid him down on the floor. His face was gray. He was dying right in front of me, and there was nothing I could do for him. McMullen, no radio, the communications Marine lying against the radio was saying over and over. You guys gotta go for help, he said. I picked up a rifle and without hesitation jumped out of the truck.
My biggest problems that I had is reliving when I got wounded. And it wasn't so much me catching the rounds, it was the other guys that were getting chopped up. And I can see it right now, but I can deal with it. You know, I can see the guy sitting across from me in the truck catching the rounds, the machine gun. I mean, just like this, he was sitting just like, and I leaned over. When I heard the rounds go off, I just happened to lean over and go for the floor. And he caught the rounds that were meant for me. Now, see, I can deal with that, and I can understand it. Okay, and when you relive those things and you can't deal with them, that's when everything starts breaking down.
Yeah, you can put a lot of it behind you and deal with it. You don't never forget it. And I'm still fighting the war in my mind.
Yeah.
Every day, you know. Yeah. You know, what ifs? The what ifs kill you.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's ever going to change. You know, this is 20 years now, and, you know.
On board the helicopter, vibrating over the island, then out to sea and along the beach. I stared at the unreal world in Nam as it passed by, then at our wounded. Uncontrollably, I dropped my head in my hands, wiped my eyes, and stared up at the gunner of the chopper, who was wearing tiger utilities and a helmet and goggles that made him look like death. He leaned on his machine gun, which was sticking out in the rain, and looked down at me through those goggles and winked. And the only way I stopped myself from blacking out was to cling to the trousers of the Marine who had taken those rounds across his neck.
Here. Shine your light on that right there. The cat's walking up and down here. Out of curiosity, you can't help but walk these things at night. And you get carried away with it, you can walk these trails most of the night. Because you figure there's something else up in the corner, you know, or you're going to come onto something. Let's go right down there where that corner is. That fantastic sound. Isn't that incredible? This is my swamp. This is the panther's swamp. And it does get to you. It starts vibrating right down into you. What can you be afraid of out here at this time? Nothing. I just soon stay here the rest of the night.
James P. McMullen's book is Cry of the Panther, Quest of a Species. Jungles of Memory was produced by Christina Egloff with Jay Allison. Music by Stacey Bowers, Gary Kvisted, and Stu Quimbe. I'm Barrett Golden, coming to you from Peak Recording in Bozeman, Montana. There's links to everything you heard at hearingvoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of soundimagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is hearingvoices.com.